It is Saturday, September 26th, 2009. 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, Geek News and your questions and comments about technology. The bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is provided by GNI, GNIHosting.com. It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks. Al Luckow, a new media architect.
Hi.
Mr. Miles Elam, student, slacker, and political junkie.
Good morning.
And Mr. Benjamin Jaffe, a freelance media guy.
Hey there.
Hey. Ben, you need more title, man.
I know.
Okay, good.
I thought you were the title maker.
Ben Jaffe, cool, young, hipster.
Not a hipster.
Not a title maker.
Not
all right, moving on. Al, you've got a nice professional-sounding title, New Media Architect. Very simple.
Yeah, I made that up like 10 years ago.
So now it's an old media architect.
Yeah.
That's depressing.
Could we say robotics analyst?
We could. And it'd almost be fair. Mr. Robotics Analyst,
say whatever you want.
Can you fill us in?
Just don't call me late for supper.
Go ahead with your first story, Mr. Luckow.
Oh, robots. Let's see. What do we got in robots? Well, there's a robot that eats people in order to save them.
Good. Perfect.
What? Delicious.
Yummy.
All right. This thing is operated by the Tokyo Fire Department. I don't want to.
Why is the Tokyo Fire Department eating people or having their robots eat people?
No, it's going to be developed in Japan.
Does it like nibble on their foot till the person screams or like, found one?
What it does is it goes into hazardous environments, finds people who are lying perfectly flat on the ground with their hands at their sides and unconscious on a smooth surface.
That happens every day.
Then it uses a conveyor belt, sort of, and scoops them up into its belly. At least that's what it looks like from the video. And, of course, it was developed in Japan.
Okay.
But judging by its size, I think it's only good for one body. Unless, through some impossible glitch, the thing goes haywire and starts scooping up people and squashing them in like a trash compactor. But that could never happen.
Never.
Those
never.
Kind of things.
So, this kind of makes sense if you're in a factory situation, right, and a chemical spill happens, something, and people knock out. Right. How do you get them to go there? So that perfectly clean environment, it's a great.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I think it's a great idea to put robots in hazardous environments.
Yeah.
To save humans.
Yeah.
But if I were somehow immobilized and this thing were coming at me with those big arms and that conveyor belt and that gaping mouth, I think I'd probably assume it's up to no good.
Soylent Green is people.
They need to at least paint flowers or smiley faces on a thing. It's a good idea.
That'll help.
Just a little PR help would be.
A little daisy on the front of it before it consumes your legs.
Well, have a nice day. Eyes. I'm here to help you. Let me eat you.
I guess if it does motivate you to leave, it succeeds that way, too.
I mean,
unless you run further into the hazardous waste.
Technically, you leave in its belly.
Okay, so if we need...
It's small. It's kind of like being sucked into like an MRI machine that's like rolling around on treads. Yeah. And that's a little creepy. I mean.
But considering it can only catch people that are laying down perfectly prone, I can get away from that one. I don't mind.
Yeah. When you faint in a clean room and nobody can go in there and get you, it's handy to have one of these robots if it can get through the door.
All right. That's by a door.
That's a big robot.
Yeah, it's big.
I like how it's rescuing someone from...
Look at those arms.
It's rescuing someone. The pictures show it rescuing someone from a street, from like on a street.
Middle of
a
the street.
Completely open area.
I, for one, welcome our people eating hazardous chemical rescue droids overlords.
Thank you, Miles. Ben, what's going on with space?
Space. All right, so apparently for some time now, a bunch of people have wanted to go to the moon and live there.
Including the honeymooners.
How do you... Alice?
What would we do without you, Miles?
Not be laughing.
What did he say? I'll send you to the moon, Alice. Or
something like that, To the moon.
We're too young
Fly
for
me
that
to the moon. Apparently, there is water on the moon. it turns out, or at least we're pretty sure of it. So it turns out we have actually detected using three different spacecraft that there is either HO, one hydrogen, one oxygen bonded together, or H2O, which is, of course, water. So we either have water or we have hydroxyl.
Ben, when you were reading this story, did you look into how hydroxyl can be stable?
No, I did not.
Is it big chains of it?
I am not a chemist, but apparently
it does seem odd.
It doesn't make any sense.
Well, okay, so what they're saying, most of the news stories are saying we found water on the moon. It's official. We know there's water on the moon. But technically, that's not entirely true. We don't know for certain. We are pretty
certain
there's water.
Can you really ever know there's for certain?
Well, the reason that we don't know is because we were using low-resolution spectroscopy for two of these three spacecraft, and we detected a signature, which is it happens when you have hydrogen and oxygen bonded together. So it doesn't say, oh, there's H2O on the moon. It says there are hydrogen-oxygen bonds on the moon. That's what we found. But that's pretty indicative of water, and also hydroxyl is a signifier that there's probably water there.
Okay, calling all chemists, I'd like to know, like right now, how do you get HO stable enough to say that that's what's on there? I mean, I get the bonds. Maybe it's some other form of, you know, HO plus something else. I don't know.
So the thing is, if astronauts are on the moon and they get thirsty, there's a possibility they might be able to get a drink.
Well,
there.
Now here's the catch. We've detected water at about 1,000 parts per million, which is, to translate, it's about 32 ounces per one for every ton of lunar material. Right?
That's a lot of chewing for that
ton
water.
Of rocks or ton of dust, you know. And you really don't want to eat. So the dust on the moon is called
regolith.
Regolith. That's it. You don't want to eat that stuff because even though there's technically water there and we've detected trace amounts of water, it's very, very trace amounts. It's still probably drier than any desert that we have.
Okay,
on
so
Earth.
We're not taking calls right now, except if you're someone that knows chemistry well enough to explain what's going on there. The phone number is 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Love to hear why HO can be stable.
Yes. But the theory behind how this is happening, they've actually detected that the water on the surface that they've detected with the spectroscopy is coming and going with every lunar day. So every time the moon
so it's precipitating
orbits. It's okay. Exactly. So the theory is that when the sun comes, it evaporates, it vaporizes, it breaks apart. And then when it is coming back into the dark area, the dark side of the moon, that's a song, right? The solar wind comes by, which is a stream of charged hydrogen particles, and those hit the oxygen, which is in the regolith and in the rocks, and creates water or creates hydroxyl. So that's a theory.
The other thing, this early solar system, when the bodies in the closed solar system lost most of their atmosphere, why we don't have large giants, or the theory why we don't have gas giants in the inner solar system. We have all these rocky planets that most atmosphere is blown away, including pretty much all the water would have been burned away too. And the theory goes that the water that's actually on Earth came in from collisions with extra bodies. So orbiting systems like have slowly collected things on the local, on the system. So it makes sense the moon would also do that. But of course, it doesn't have enough gravitational well to hold on to these particles.
Yeah, I mean,
so
there's
something that's actually creating it all the time.
There's also a lot to be said for the idea that that asteroids and your meteorites, comets, which are a lot of them just big balls of ice and rock, right? Mm-hmm. They're impacting the Earth all the time, and they're impacting the moon as well all the time, as well as Mars. And all
well, thank you for that moon update. Maybe,
cool stuff.
Maybe in a minute we'll find out more about water in the solar system.
It's making me thirsty, that story.
You know, I'm thirsty too, and all I have is coffee, which is a diuretic.
Kind of.
So, Miles, today we're going to change things around a bit. Most of the time, Al covers all the robot stories, but this robot story is definitely yours because you're the English major.
Yeah, the fact that it's a robot, that's a little off.
That's what the headline said.
Right, but it's a program. It's a computer program. What makes this program a little different, though, is that it's being used to grade the English papers in one of England's three major exam boards. So it's actually student papers.
You know, when you described this story earlier, just for me to understand what we're going to talk about, I assumed it was in like a high school or something. This is in like a major university level.
No. This is the equivalent of high school level.
Thank you. not familiar with the education system in England. Okay, so people's grades will be determined by a robot's analysis of their English?
Yes.
I'm surprised.
So, graded by a computer.
I'm surprised it's not like a Japanese grading robot.
That would be hard to grade English with Japanese.
Yeah, it just seems like...
Well, you just use Babelfish, right?
For the UK to do something...
I see what you're saying. Right. It doesn't seem like something that the education board in the UK would do. Right. So
the worries that people have are that the nuance in English language a computer can't detect and wouldn't be able to grade effectively.
But I bet those students will learn how to write appropriately for that robot.
Well, there's the worry. One of the main criticisms is that people will learn to write for the computer, not for better English papers.
Right.
That they'll try to do some more form of watered down one.
Pay attention to the paperclip in Microsoft, is what you're saying.
They'll be making stories that appeal to robots.
But at the same time, I've seen I've seen research about this in the past, and they've been conspicuously accurate. Like, you give a paper, and they'll give a certain grade, and it'll be very close because it's doing a pattern recognition. The computer doesn't understand English, per se.
Okay, so is that how they're doing it?
But it can follow structure and follow patterns for
Will it actually, like, go, you know, from a fuzzy logic analysis of this and the millions of papers I actually have grades on, this is the paper grade? Or is it going to say, here, grammatically, you're wrong, or you're using the wrong word here? I mean, the spelling's not going to be an issue, but using the correct words or using the correct grammar or punctuation, that's pretty hard
this
to
article,
do.
This article doesn't have
details.
The details on it. But at the same time, pretty hard to do. Checking grammar is something that we've seen in Microsoft Word for years. To find out if they have the right punctuation, that's a solved problem.
Why is Microsoft so bad at it? I mean, you can form relatively good sentences.
On the contrary.
Yes?
We are really bad at it. There are some times where Microsoft Word will show a false positive. But there are far many times where the grammar that's coming up, Microsoft has to tweak Word to fit our bad grammar.
Okay, but you've always said to me, Miles, that English is not a set-in-stone thing. It's something that we change and manipulate, and as time goes, the users help to define the language itself. That's how language exists.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that you're going to have some rule set that's the rule set, you know, you're going to take I was going to say Keeble and Shuckett, but what's the that's a photo store. What's the, like, one of those standard style guides? What's the style guide that everybody seems to quote?
Well, there's Strunk and White. There's Chicago Manual style.
Okay, but these all have different ideas on what's appropriate and what's not appropriate, which one's going to be used, and then how do you say the entire nation will be defined by that?
But we're talking about two different things. And just to give some backstory of our conversation, you were talking about how people communicate in general.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking about, in this case, an academic environment, which is not teaching necessarily how everyone speaks at large and making a value judgment on it. It's talking about the lingua franca, as the common English, the standard English that everyone can agree upon.
Okay.
And what you speak at home and what you speak in your day-to-day life may not...
But you and I both know how to program, and therefore we could start trying to figure out how to write an application that would do this kind of analysis, right, and figure out the correct structures. We're going to make assumptions, or we're going to follow rules. We're going to have to follow some rule. Whose is it? Who's the defining, you know, if you go along with this dictionary's idea of grammatical structure, you're okay.
But there are programs that can analyze another program, a piece of source code, to see whether or not it has any defects.
I'm not talking about defects. I'm talking about the decisions of when a comma is appropriate in a list. I'm talking about just general rules of that nature. Those are style rules.
Oh, those are pretty easy. Those are going to be... A serial comma actually is correct.
A serial comma or use a...
But once again, we're in an academic environment. You're talking about a punctuation rule. That is pretty well... That's easy to define. That's easy to say. You have to have a serial comma. You have to have
So are they going to decide, you know, when you're doing a list, to have a comma before the last and or not? This kind of style of things, I'm curious about. Who defines that if every person is going to be going across that? When you're in a learning environment and you have a teacher grading the paper and they see that style, they might talk to the student, you can do it that way or you don't have to do it that way. There might be some
education in this case, about that. The reviewers are never talking to the student after the fact. These are examinations.
These are final exams.
Yeah.
It's an interesting idea. I'm a little concerned about robots helping to decide.
But as I said, in that is the worry. But at the same time, the history has shown when they've put programs on this and then they've had human reviewers, the scores have been remarkably similar.
Okay. So they're testing.
Yes.
Good. I like it.
Oh, certainly. Yes.
Well, thank you very much. Al, I think it's time for another robot story that's a real robot, something physical. No offense, Miles.
Another robot story. Okay.
The Gladiator one is one.
There was a tournament in, of course, Japan. It's Toyama. That's a real place, I guess. Toyama, where it was the 16th Robo One Robotic Gladiatorial Tournament. And
I didn't know gladiatorial was a word. Well, that's fantastic. Word.
It's amazing. We'll have to check with Miles'
English
robot. Right?
That's getting into my lexicon.
Well, this robot was steered by its controller's neural signals.
Did you say there?
It's so basically this student, a fourth year student at the University of Electrocommunications in Tokyo. His name is Taku Ichikawa. He built this robot that is controlled by connecting electrodes to his brain, you know, just like on the outside of his head. And he just thinks about how to control the robot, and it makes it that the robot's 50 centimeters tall, 2 kilograms, and he's able to put this robot in this gladiator competition. He's basically controlling the robot by thinking. That the only issue with it is to move right, you have to think. It's not like you're thinking move right. You're thinking of something specific, like say, like a sunflower, okay, and that means move right. So you get these images in your head, these strong images that have particular controls. You're not thinking move right. You're thinking sunflower, and then it goes that way.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so you have to have these images.
So you have to have enough difference in your contrast in the thought pattern in your brain,
right,
for it to read it.
Right, and It takes about a second. It takes a total of about 1.5 seconds for the thoughts to be transferred into the robot action, 1 second for the electrodes to read the neural signals, and another 0.5 seconds to determine which movement is intended. So
that seems pretty slow for the movement intention.
It's a second late, you know, a second and a half late, but the robot's got some things programmed into it, so when it's attacked, if it falls down, it can get up immediately, you know.
It probably can block itself.
It can do certain things, but just the thought of
semi-autonomous and
being able to control a robot with your mind, you know. I mean, it reminds me of that movie Firefox.
Yeah, or the movie Surrogates that is out.
Oh, the one that's coming out, yeah.
Actually, I think it opened today.
It's just, you know, it's really neat. I mean, you always think about how you can control something just from your mind. I think this technology was an offshoot from work that was done for wheelchairs for people who couldn't control.
Right, we've seen that early on, to be able to do stuff,
right,
small movement with your
brain. Yeah, and so this is that same kind of technology that
just used for robots fighting.
For robots killing each other.
Yeah. And so I guess I think it's kind of good that there's really clear pattern stuff, because what if he decides to sneeze, right, and he thinks about not sneezing,
right?
And the robot starts doing that. Or, you know, he decides to, someone hands him a cup of coffee and unfortunately gets spilled in his lap, and then he like jumps up and freaks out, and of course the robot's throwing around.
It's a neat idea, and I think just, you know, just from the, you know, number of years that people are working on this, it's really going to be a short time until we're able to control things through our thoughts. I mean, this particular type of thing, you have to hook stuff up to your head,
right?
Which is, you know, awkward.
I have stuff hooked on my head all the time.
Actually, we all have things hooked up to our head right now.
Right now, yeah.
So I don't know how weird that is, you know? Yeah.
Well, yours is pink, so that's kind of strange.
Well, that's, you know, my personal style.
That's true. And you've got nice style.
Yeah.
Ben, water on the moon a second ago, and?
Well, a couple Mars stories.
Wait, did you use well as in like a well of water?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I did, didn't
nice.
I?
Very
that
funny.
Really cool.
I won't mention it so it sounds smooth.
Okay, beautiful. Thank you for that segue. So, yes, so a couple of Mars stories, actually. The first one is not water related. We have done some three-dimensional imaging of the Martian North Polar ice caps, or ice layers, and that's on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, excuse me. And it turns out that Martian climate swings may have actually been happening over the last million years. Going down and looking at this three-dimensionally with a radar, The data suggests that we do actually have Martian climate cycles, much like we do on Earth. Whereas here on Earth, we can, you know, dig down into rocks and we can see all the different layers of sediment and figure out what happened. And then about the ice, another camera on the reconnaissance orbiter found that there is actually ice much lower latitude-wise, much lower on Mars than we thought there was. We already knew that there was ice up on the North Pole. Mm-hmm. In the north area and the south pole, I assume as well. But we found that it actually extends much, much closer to the equator, all the way down to, we actually took imagery from 40 to 60 degrees north, and we found that there's ice there. There's ice when the surface is disturbed. So at landing sites or when right. there are impacts.
Before it sublimes.
Exactly, yes. Which is really cool. And the other thing that we found is we expected that if we'd see ice down there, we'd see about a 50-50 mixture of ice and dirt. But it turns out it's more of a 99%, 1% mixture. We have very pure ice on Mars that's created when, or that is revealed when the surface is disturbed. So,
very cool.
Anyway, and just to give you an idea also, around 40 degrees north, which is the southernmost area that we imaged during this mission.
Which area?
40 degrees north. That's okay. Around where New York is on Earth, to give you an idea of okay. how far north and south that is. So, anyway, cool stuff. So there's water all over the place in this.
And
in
you
this
can get
system.
Not only that, but cold water.
Very cold.
Yes, you can get a cold, if you're on Mars, you can get a cold drink.
Yes, actually, it's something
ice. We know this is ice water.
Ice water?
Yeah. Yeah, it's ice water, and based on
or
how
water,
long it took...
Water ice, I should say.
based on how long it took to break apart and everything, right. we figured out how much ice it was. Actually, something I forgot to mention about the moon thing, which I just forgot, so never mind.
You know, I just mentioned one thing, that there's an application called Google Earth by Google. It's a 3D model of the Earth, and you can explore the Earth in this really amazing way if you've got a computer that has OpenGL support, which your computer probably does if you have a computer. In any case, you download Google Earth and you do that. And then under View on Google Earth, there's a tab for Explore, or a menu item for Explore, and you can choose the sky, which means you get to see what Earth looks like or what the constellations look like from Earth right now. You can also look at Earth, of course, and Mars and the Moon. And as this data comes in, they're not great about really quickly adding in, but it gets added in. So the picture and the 3D model of the Moon and of Mars is getting more and more detailed. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, what's also really neat is with Google Maps, they released Google Moon. I can't remember when they released that, but it turns out when you zoom in too far, you get a bunch of cheese.
Yeah.
Because the really? Moon is really made of cheese. The thing I was going to really quickly mention is that with the Moon study, they found that because of the dehydration, rehydration of the trace water along the surface, they are theorizing it could lead to that water migrating to areas of the Moon that never see sunlight, like the certain parts of craters, which means that there would actually be water accumulating there, ice water accumulating there, and not ever breaking up. So that cool. could be very good if we decide to go to the Moon. We could pull from there.
Al, what's a podcast you're interested in this week?
Cool Hunting at coolhunting.com. It's a video podcast, and I can't imagine somebody watching this and not liking it, because it explores different things. One time it'll be talking about a singer, another time it'll be talking about an aspiring artist, and they're short video segments, and it looks like they're done in HD, or they're at least widescreen. And basically they spend about five to 8 minutes exploring this person and letting them talk. Mm-hmm. And it's very hip, very neat, called Cool Hunting. And I think you should check it out if you're into this sort of stuff. If you like video podcasts, it's free. You can get it on iTunes or just watch it on
and
the
you
web.
Can find it from GeekSpeak website, yep. geekspeak.org. And of course, today's show is September 26, 2009. The geeks today are Ben Jaffe. He's a freelance media guy. And and we have Ben Jaffe, a new media. Wait, did I just say that twice?
Yeah, apparently there are two of me.
Okay. And then we have Ben. So, oh, wait, Miles and Al as well. Miles Elam is a political junkie and student in English Lit at UCS. You're about to graduate, right?
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
And Ben is like Walt Whitman. He is vast. He contains multitudes.
Ooh,
yes.
Can you do alliteration the entire show? That'd be wonderful. Let's try it with Al. Al Luckow is a new media architect. Nothing, Miles?
Oh, sorry.
Nothing. Okay.
Draws a blank.
That's because new media is not in classic literature. All right. We got a call coming in, and we'll take that in just 1 second. Miles, what's going on with browser updates? What's going on with Chrome?
Google has announced a plugin for Internet Explorer 6, 7, and 8 on Windows Vista and Windows XP called Google Chrome Frame. What this does is it basically tells Internet Explorer's rendering engine and JavaScript engine to take a backseat, sit this one out while, you know, the big kids handle the web browser.
On GeekSpeak all the time, we mention that you should, if you're on a Windows machine, you should go ahead and go over, switch over to Firefox or Chrome or Safari. There's a lot of browsers out there. Normally, the vulnerabilities on Windows machines come, I mean, a lot of them come through Internet Explorer, but there's actually an underlying thing that Miles and I are doing to push this other browser. It's that Internet Explorer has horrible standard support, which means that if Miles and I code something that's pretty and amazing and beautiful and elegant, and you open the Internet Explorer, it looks like a robot did it.
So this is actually the issue that Google has. Google is the web space. Their mail client does this. Their calendar client does this. And they always have
all these web applications that run in your browser. Yeah.
Right. And they have to bend over backwards trying to get things to work in Internet Explorer. The same code that works with very little modification between Mozilla Firefox or Apple Safari or Opera, the Opera browser. With Internet Explorer, suddenly you're speaking a completely different language or just enough that you don't understand what's going on. And so it's in Google's best interest to put in this technology that evens the playing field, as it were. Because there are a lot of companies, specifically, that are still running Internet Explorer 6 that don't want to change because a lot of their internal infrastructure is based upon applications written to Internet Explorer 6. So they can't even go to Internet Explorer 7 or 8 because it would break their internal workflow.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, and the thing is, I mean, you could install another browser, not Internet Explorer 7 or 8. You could install an Internet Explorer, you know, Firefox or, you know, a direct browser, right, you know, a new browser. But a lot of people don't like the idea of running extra software, especially open source software. There seems to be a bit of a...
Actually, the big thing that I've heard from people with regard to Firefox and other browsers has been the inability to use group policies to determine behavior for it.
Interesting.
Because group policies are, if for those of you who are not, who don't, have never heard of them.
Like me.
With Windows, you have the ability to, if you have an Active Directory network,
I see.
To be able to push out applications to be installed in the corporate network for each individual machine. So this is, someone has their computer that's sitting off in some desk. The administrator doesn't have to walk over to that desk and put in CDs and install the software. All they have to do is from their central console say, that computer
should get this application.
This gets this application and has these settings.
Okay. So if you're stuck or desire to use Internet Explorer, but you want to see the new features of the cutting-edge web development stuff, like using Gmail and other applications of that sort, but also just in general doing really cool, elegant things, which Miles plays with all the time, you could install this Chrome plugin, Chrome Frame plugin from Google. It's not actually out yet, right? They're working on it?
No, it's out. Yeah,
so I'd highly recommend it. It's just another plugin like Flash. And while you're at it, actually, on any browser, updating software on your computer is really important. One of the things that is hard to remember to upgrade would be your plugins. So go ahead and get the most recent Flash plugin, for example.
One thing about the Google Chrome Frame, though, is it requires opt-in by page authors. They either need to put in a meta tag that has a HTTP header. I think you can just set the HTTP header as well. Or the user has to put in a CF prefix to the URL to let it know that you want the Chrome Frame.
So CF HTTP? Or
right.
CF
colon HTTP colon /.
Interesting, like a namespace kind of thing.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It registers a protocol handler.
So any page you want, you could force Chrome to do it.
Yes.
Ooh, that's cool. I'm going to start installing Chrome.
But you were talking about for individual users. I'd actually say individual users, if you're really set on Internet Explorer, yes, use it. But individual users, just use Firefox, just use Google Chrome, just use Safari. Safari.
I get that, but wouldn't it be awesome if we could do, I don't know, fonts in CSS? You know, some features that,
right?
If
no,
everyone had this, the web would be more beautiful and
right,
elegant.
But lovely. Most people who have the older versions of IE are either corporate users. That's the vast majority of people who have Internet Explorer 6 at this point. Most everyone else is upgraded through Windows Update. Or you have just you don't have the knowledge level to say, I want to put in a new browser, which means you're probably not going to download Google Frame and Chrome Frame and put in this new software. So right. I guess that's this back and forth there.
All right. Thank you very much for that update on browsers. I'm really excited about having more people be able to do cool things on the web, so it's always a nice advance.
Yes.
From Big Sur, John, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, how are you tonight?
Well, quite well, John. Are you ready to switch over to frequency in Big Sur?
Yes, we are. The new 95. Was it 4, I believe?
Oh, let me look that up real quick.
But what I wanted to talk about is...
The new frequency in Big Sur will be 95.3.
Three?
Yep.
Close.
Yeah, here's a little thing everyone should know about FM. You'll notice that always the dot something is always an odd number. And the reason that is that every 200... it doesn't matter exactly the distance. You don't want to give one person, 88, right, or 89. You want to always have
that extension. I have a first-class FCC license.
You do. Very cool. Well, I wasn't telling you. I was telling everybody. But anyway, go on.
Yeah, there's a great program I've been noticing. I work on AI programs. Mm-hmm. And... I'm trying to get one to really, I've thought on like Snow Crash, the Librarian, and I ran across what Lionheart is doing in England on a program called Milo for the 360i. This is the most incredible AI thing I've ever seen. If you can Google Lionheart Milo.
Is that the game?
This is something that is not out yet. It's the latest release from the AI labs there, mm-hmm. and it's the most far out thing I've ever seen.
Huh?
YouTube videos as such.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And I'd be interested because the blogs are all going how people are going to like this in their gaming. Mm-hmm. But I see this as something that could be used like for older people, returning veterans, like a librarian assistant, like in the book Snow Crash. Mm-hmm. It's already at that capability level.
Right.
And it's not even released yet. Check it out. I think you'd really
We'll check it out. I know I like the book Snow Crash.
It is associated, by the way, with the game. The Milo game.
Okay.
So
maybe it's too coincidental not to.
Have any of you seen that video?
I haven't watched it yet, but I intend to do that right after GeekSpeak is over.
Yeah, check it out.
I'm too bad we couldn't have discussed it on, but yeah, that is the heaviest thing I've seen out there in ever. It's really amazing. Guys, check it out.
Okay. All right, we'll put it up on the website in just a few minutes. Thank you so much for the call.
You bet.
Bye-bye. Yeah, the artificial intelligence stuff that's coming around is always kind of creepily cool. I guess is the best way to say it.
Of course, we're into organic intelligence at our house. It all has to be organic. My wife just gets organic intelligence.
You do not like artificial intelligence?
No.
Yeah.
No preservatives.
All right, we got another call coming in, but let's go ahead and do one more news story. I wanted to cover, we'll cover a few more news stories, but what's going on with Microsoft Courier?
Oh, yeah. There's a YouTube video out that's showing the Microsoft Courier tablet. It's like the secret leak of what Microsoft is doing. It's a pretty cool video of a tablet computer supposedly being designed by Microsoft. It folds open like a book, has a full touchscreen interface. The video shows some really awesome effects and intuitive controls. Of course, in my mind, this qualifies as what we creative directors call slideware or vaporware.
Ah.
In other words, this is a video that was created in some compositor like After Effects or something. And it's not a real computer UI functioning in front of you. As an example, I also found a video over 20 years old that Apple did that looks a lot like this. I mean, a lot like this.
Okay.
20 years ago. And that was before the interweb,
Right.
Both of these videos are linked to from geekspeak.org, and they're really worth a look. All that aside, the prospect of a notebook tablet is really exciting, and I'm happy to see people posting fanciful visions of what it could be, because that's how real products are born. It's a really neat looking tablet. Shows the person moving a journal around and taking pictures and cutting things out and sliding them around and moving them. It's I think this is a really geeky thing to watch. It's totally cool.
Very cool. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Ben, can you tell us if it's the future yet? Is it a flying car or is it just a car?
It depends on how often you evaluate your current frame of reality.
It'll be the future in a few minutes.
All right, so tell us about electric cars.
Yes, so electric cars, one cool thing about electric cars as opposed to normal cars or even hybrid cars when they switch into electric mode is they're very, very quiet. But I'm sure many people listening have had the thought of, well, what about pedestrians? What if you're crossing the street and you rely on hearing the car, right? And so you don't necessarily look to your left or to your right. You just walk because you don't hear a car there. And, you know, oftentimes this can be disastrous. Same with bicyclists. You know, you do a shoulder check when you hear a car behind you. But if you don't hear the car, that's a problem. So turns out there's a campaign for making electric and hybrid cars noisier, meaning instead of actually making the hardware, the physical parts of the car, the mechanics make the sound. Mm-hmm. They've decided that when a car is below a certain speed, it's going to emit a sound. Right?
Like, you could always put like a playing card in its wheel. You know, just like tape it like you do on your bike.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep. I'd like to draw a comparison to when we got cell phones as opposed to when we had normal phones, right? All of a sudden, you have this huge market for ringtones. Now anyone's car can sound like they want it to. So you can have Jetson's car.
I think that says, I'm moving.
Get out of my way. Get out of my way.
Well, it's also like a digital camera.
Or I think I can.
This sounds like it's going to be a complete disaster.
I think this is a terrifying idea to let consumers decide what their car sounds like.
Are they letting consumers decide? Well, that's
the idea, right? Okay. I mean, in the future, I'm sure that's going to happen, right?
Man, that's weird.
So in any case.
Here's the thing is you can't emit amplified music, amplified sounds from your car. It's not supported in almost all areas. Unless it's
negative sound.
Oh, good
noise canceling, that's actually technically you're doing the exact opposite of the sound your car makes.
Well, no, I think that there's a decibel thing. If the sound being emitted from your car, either from speakers inside the car or whatever, exceeds a certain amount,
I think ice cream trucks have to have a license. Like,
interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure that these electric cars that will have this feature will have a license or something.
They should just pick an official sound.
Now, what's happening now is Nissan sound engineers are working on this. The story is covering them. The Leaf electric car, which is supposedly going to be released next year, will emit, and let me quote, a beautiful and futuristic noise. So kind of Blade Runner style, you know, in any case. So, I don't know, pretty cool stuff.
Thank you very much for that. We are taking calls today with questions and comments about technology, more specifically stuff about the show. If you'd like to ask and participate about what we're talking about, please feel free to give us a ring. The phone numbers are 476-2800. That's again 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. All right. So, Miles, it's your turn, sir. E. coli?
Well, nuclear waste actually is the issue I wanted to talk about, especially with regard to uranium mining.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always been an issue with how do you clean it up? And
you're not talking about post use. You're talking about during the process of mining it.
Right.
Okay.
Especially, and Europe specifically is looking at it because they, especially France, uses a fair amount of nuclear power.
They have an industry about it.
Right. But they also don't have very much in the way of uranium resources. So they need to maximize what they have. So it seems like, well, getting it out of the environment would be a win-win scenario. They can use it and they're getting it out of waste streams that are going into the environment from polluted waters, you know, resulting from uranium mining, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're using a bacteria and inositol phosphate, a chemical similar to the waste material that that plants will generate.
Okay.
And they can recover uranium from the polluted waters surrounding uranium mines this way. And this bacteria just happens to be E. coli.
So I heard this great thing, maybe it was on Geek Speak, that E. coli is probably the most well-understood organism on the planet because so much of it's used in labs and such. So it makes sense that you take an organism like that and start using it in this form. How does that actually help, though, in the cleanup process? Because you still have the material.
The phosphate will bind to the uranium, forming a uranium phosphate precipitate.
And a beautiful
that
flower.
that will coat the bacterial cells, which then you can harvest to recover the uranium.
Gotcha. So it makes it easier to collect at it.
Yeah.
Yes. Very cool.
It's no longer free floating. It becomes bound to the bacteria that you're putting into the water.
You shouldn't eat the uranium, though, because it has E. coli on it.
A minute ago, we talked about, we had a caller from Big Sur talking about AIs, and he mentioned Snow Crash kind of in passing, but I just want to mention that Snow Crash is a Neal Stephenson's novel. If you're really interested in, like, well, it's kind of a geek de facto book. Like, all of us have read it. Ben, yep. Please tell me you've read Snow Crash.
Mm,
oh, my God.
Ben has a homework assignment. Ben, I will tease you every week.
It came out in 92.
Oh, no, well, before he's born, so that doesn't count.
Yeah, exactly. I was born in 98, so.
Yeah, right. So, please, Ben, please read Snow Crash. Mm-hmm. If you haven't read it, next week when you come to the house, I'm going to hand you a copy, and you need to read it. It's an awesome book. Like, seriously, okay?
Okay.
Everybody else, okay. I don't really care. I don't know.
Yeah. Let me just do a quick follow-up just to finish off the story.
Please.
With regard to cost. The process was first described in 1995, but it was fairly expensive. Now they're looking at prices of about 15 cents for every gram of recovered uranium. So considering that at 2007 prices, uranium costs about, I'd say about 30 cents a gram, then 15 cents a gram for recovering
helps.
From waste stream is definitely a boon.
Yeah,
from both
well,
an economic standpoint and from an environmental standpoint.
The environmental one seems a little bit more important, but it's nice that it's economically viable, therefore companies will do it by default without having to be mandated to do so. We have another call. Good, I think.
We've got lots of calls.
We're just
really? Blinking like crazy.
All right. I'm gonna hope that this is Doug from Santa Cruz. Doug, welcome to GeekSpeak. Hello, welcome to GeekSpeak. It's not Doug. No.
It's a ghost.
It is. Well, maybe Doug will call in, call back. We have a few more minutes to do so. All right. So, Al, tell us about white spaces.
Oh, yeah.
You're a designer, so you're talking about white space on a design.
I'm always talking about white space, but this is a different kind. It's a Wi-Fi via white spaces. You know how all the TV frequencies are all going digital now? Well, all that spectrum that was being used for a TV broadcast is now just, like, open. And there's it was presented at the ACM SIGCOM conference in Barcelona, Spain. And basically, TV stations have traditionally broadcast over lower frequencies that carry information longer distances. But with the ongoing transition to analog, from analog to digital, those unused frequencies are opening up, and people are trying to take advantage of that. And what they want to do is they want to tap into these frequencies and use them for Wi-Fi access,
mm-hmm.
which basically what it's going to do is it's going to allow a much further distance from your Wi-Fi hotspot, say a mile. You know, you'll be able to go, you know, your router will go a mile, you know, so you'll...
Wow.
Yeah, like, or more. I mean, it's... that. So this is what's going on right now. The FCC ruled last November that companies could build devices that transmit over white spaces, but also gave strict requirements that this should not interfere with existing broadcasts, blah, blah, blah. You know, so they're moving that way now, so we may be looking at much further distances for our Wi-Fi in the future via these unused frequencies.
Very cool. And, of course, the hardware you currently have won't do this, but the potential for that last-mile connectivity, like small neighborhoods getting Wi-Fi, mm-hmm. which is something that like local ISPs are really interested in because they could potentially skip the AT&T network or the phone system networks and actually provide really fast service in local neighborhoods.
I mean, for
really
those,
exciting stuff.
For those guys out there who are interested, it's the 512 megahertz and 698 megahertz between those areas.
Great. And of course, anything we cover on GeekSpeak, you're welcome to look up more details from our website, geekspeak.org. From Santa Cruz, Doug, welcome to GeekSpeak.
He's just really shy.
What?
Hello.
Hi, Doug. Hi. Welcome.
Hello?
Yes, yes, you're on.
Oh, I couldn't tell whether you could hear me or not.
We can now. What's your question?
Yes, notebooks. They're coming out with new notebooks that are good value, like HP and Acer. And I'm wondering what you would recommend at the best value. I see one for $249 that has, you know, speakers and has all the capabilities of a home computer.
Are we talking about netbooks specifically?
They're mini computers.
Yeah, netbooks.
Mini laptops.
Yeah, these mini laptops we call netbooks. Currently, Miles is using one right now. He's using an E, which is 3 E's.
An E PC.
But all of these companies are spitting them out. The reason is that you're getting portability and low cost and trading it for power, I would say. Wouldn't
for
you,
CPU's time, yeah.
And hand cramping. The keyboards are very small.
Yes.
But I don't think... I think right now the best way to do an analysis, because there's so many of these out there, is to do a little trick I like to call, help me, Amazon, help me. And that is that you just go to Amazon and you find a good sale.
Yeah, right? I did. I went through all that, and I came up with HP and Acer were the two top ones. And they said that Acer was the better one because it had more keyboard accessibility.
Yeah, well, so the Amazon reviews, the reason why I mention Amazon, for everybody else that doesn't know this trick, you go up to Amazon, you find the model of the product you're interested in buying someplace. You don't have to be buying it on Amazon. You go up there and you take a look at what people are reviewing, how people are reviewing that product on Amazon, whether they had a good experience with it or not, because, of course, that's what you want to know. You want to know if your neighbor had a good experience with that product. Don't necessarily read the marketing stuff that's in the beginning, which actually comes from the company. Who cares what they say? What we care about is what the people that actually use it care.
Customer feedback.
The customer feedback's the part. So take a look at those reviews. Also, this is a trick on Amazon. If it's a really uncommon product or something that people don't, there's not a lot of sales, it's very common for the company itself to have their support staff filling out bogus reviews. So you've got to be careful and make sure that you think it's an accurate thing. If you see a lot of ones on a product and then you also see a lot of fives, these are the stars, then you've got to kind of wonder why are some people loving it and some people absolutely hating it. In any case, comparisons on Amazon is the way to go. So you take a look at a few of these products and then, you know, do your own research. So you, Doug, you already knew this trick, and you're going to go ahead and go with an Acer and HP product. Both those companies have fine products. Again, make sure that you want one of these things, right? Go play with one.
I wouldn't really buy one small. If it was my only machine. I mean, right. I might buy a notebook because I see Miles here with his, and it's really nice. And I've got
which one are you using? What company could I ask?
Yeah, he's using an E.
It's by Asus.
How do you spell that?
E-E-E.
From Asus?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. At the same time, I like this one. It was also the cheapest possible one I could get, so there are some trade-offs. It wouldn't necessarily be the same one I would get if I wasn't constraining my budget so much on it.
What would you
That's
get if you were
of mine as
yeah.
well?
Mine is.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you for the call.
Yeah, mine is 8.9-inch screen, so 9-inch screen. I'd actually
That's
recommend
diagonal, right?
folks.
That's pretty small.
Yeah, I'd recommend that people get a 10 or 11-inch screen.
It's like a spare computer, you know.
Yeah, the 10-inch screen and the 11-inch screen ones allow for a larger keyboard. With the 9-inch screens, the keyboard ends up being extremely anemic.
Ed, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hello, Ed. Welcome to GeekSpeak. What's your question today, or where are you calling from, Ed?
Oh, I'm calling from Paso.
Paso. Where is Paso?
Robles.
Paso Robles. Okay, good. I thought that maybe there's another town with a very similar name. That's good.
So no. We've been tossed off the end of the world by your station. I have to go to the computer to listen to you.
That's right. All right.
I graduated from a college that has a lot of education stuff and centered in the has a lot of stuff to do with the uranium mining industry and processing. And this one aspect of uranium that has not been thoroughly discussed and is that the miners in the areas around the mines have a great incidence of cancer.
Right. You know what? Unfortunately, I'm going to have to say goodbye to you because we're running out of time on GeekSpeak. Please feel free to fill us in on our forums. We'd love to hear more talk about that. The mining operation, of course, is very messy, and that's what the story is about. Mm-hmm. Thank you for calling. The Geeks Today, Miles Elam, Ben Jaffe, Al Luckow. Of course, GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online today with David Lawrence and is used by permission.
Al here, bringing you GeekSpeak's crazy USB device of the week. It was dark that evening. I was still in my office, not expecting much out of a day that was only filled with dead ends and lost souls. And then she walked in. Her lips were red and her eyes were dark. She looked at me and asked for my help. something about her PC not being able to see her Mac on her network. I don't remember. It was her eyes. She had control over my every thought. I had to remember this moment. Good thing I had my USB Zippo lighter spy cam. Well, it wasn't really a Zippo, but the point is it looked like one. And it could easily take video through a pinhole lens at 16 frames per second. I slowly tilted the USB Zippo lighter spy cam so as to capture her in glorious 640 by 480 resolution. She looked at me with those big brown eyes and said, "Why are you sticking that lighter in my face? Are you trying to burn me like I've been burned so many times before?" I told her, no, it's not that. It's really a USB Zippo lighter spy cam, and I'm filming you. That slap stung like a belly flop off a 40-foot high dive. As I watched her go, I thought to myself, that was one crazy USB device I should have kept in my pocket.